And Vakasha, Dr. Mark, we look forward to a great class because we're going to miss you for 4 weeks. So.
Yes, but I can't promise I'm going to end at a good time. We'll still be in the middle, but every class is sort of independent. We'll do what we can. Let me get right to it then. I was wondering, we spoke about the Manhattan Arif. So here's the picture I want to show you of the current Manhattan Arif. It goes to 145th Street. Includes the park, as you can see, Riverside Park, some of it, and then it goes all the way to the bottom of Manhattan. Now, I was wondering because I was certain that the Arif, the old Manhattan Arif from Rav Kasher, which Rav Henkin agreed with, as I recall, and many others. They included the entire island. So I confirmed this with Rabbi Adam Mintz. It did confirm the whole entire island. What happened was in 2005, they had a meeting that there was a problem. There had been the configuration of seawalls and piers that had existed, but much had changed. I'm reading an email from the Manhattan Arif people, including the structural configuration of the seawalls and piers. And therefore, in 2005, it was decided not to rely anymore on the Manhattan Arif. So they put up this new Arif. And there already was a separate Arif since 99 on the Upper West Side, and I think also maybe on the Upper East Side. So here you have it. And this is, as far as I know, it's accepted for anyone who accepts Arif in. So there it is. Thank you, Hyman. A number of classes ago, I showed you the image in the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side of Arnie Rothstein's plaque. And we spoke about Arnie Rothstein. Well, Hyman, who just got around to listening to that talk, sent me, which I didn't know, but I see now it's on the Wikipedia page of Bugsy Siegel in the Bialystoker Show in Manhattan. That's on the Lower East Side. You have Benjamin Siegel as Bugsy Siegel. So there you have. There's a plaque there for him. And right above it, that's his father, Max Siegel, who predeceased him by a few months. If you don't know who Bugsy Siegel is, look it up. You can also see there's a big plaque out in Vegas for him where he's buried. So thank you very much for that, Hyman. In terms of... mayors of New York, I think, some of you knew it last class. I pulled it up here. Actually, I don't know if I have it. Well, that's not it. If you look I don't have it here. In many sites, if you Google first Jewish mayor of New York City, believe it or not, you'll pull up all these sites, Jewish sites also, that say it's Abraham Beam. They don't realize it's LaGuardia. Not only is LaGuardia Jewish, although he didn't identify as Jewish, but he is halachically Jewish, his mother is from the Luzzatto family, one of the most yichustic, important Italian families. There's a family of the Ramchal and of Shadal. And so he has very good yichus, much better yichus than Abraham Beam or Ed Koch or Michael Bloomberg, for that matter. We ended the last class. Much of it was devoted to Frankel's opinion and the other opinions about having a monument. Is that halachically permissible? And Rabbi Mordechai from Brooklyn called my attention. I have the story, but I had forgotten about it, to a few tshuvot in the responsa of Rabbi Herzog, Chief Rabbi Herzog, which I think you'll find interesting. First of all, in volume 5, number 158, he was asked by Montevideo, Uruguay, about setting up a monument in memory of the Holocaust victims, just like a monument of stone. And he says that it's not the Jewish way. It's better to give money, tzedakah. But technically, as we saw, he agrees, there's nothing wrong with it. Now, then he says, at the very end of the tshuva, he says that he was told by Rav Shlomo David Kahana, he was the Rav of, not the Rav, he's often called the Rav of Warsaw, But he wasn't. There wasn't one Rav of Warsaw. He was one of the big Rabbanim in Warsaw, and then he becomes Rav of the old city of Jerusalem. He dies, I think, in 51. He was the father of Zanvil Kahana. He was a leader of Mizrahi. He told Rav Herzog as follows. Rav Herzog cites him as saying this, that in the shul of the Gra in Vilna, right next to the Aron Kodesh, they made a matseva. They made like a stone, like a monument. And on the stone, it said, this is where the Gra sat. And he says, if this was permitted in a shul right near the time when the Gra died, certainly you could do it in a cemetery. Yeah. So they had like a monument of sorts in the Vilna Gaon's shul. Then he quotes something in a different tshuva, and I thank you, Rabbi Mordechai, for this as well. This is in Siman Mem Dalid, page 151. It's incredible. But it, and you might say you don't trust the messenger, because he's quoting here. The tshuva is about the famous question about the form of the menorah. Rav Herzog has a long response on this, because if you come with me on the trips to Italy, you learn all about the menorah. The menorah that is on the Arch of Titus, which was put up after Titus's death. Titus is the commander who brought back all the booty. It's like that's the picture we have. Just like if we had reporters then taking pictures, we have a picture. I think it's put up in 74, so soon after the time. And then we lose track of the menorah. Vespasian put it in this temple of peace of his, and then we lose track of it. Must have been melted down or something. For the gold, it's not found in the Vatican, that's for sure. But you see the menorah there, and it has a base on it. And that base has like images of like dragons and other things, which is explicitly against halacha, based upon what we have in the Talmud. It tells us you can't. So Rav Herzog has a whole response on this, and it was a problem because the state of Israel adopted the menorah as the symbol. But the original menorah looks like this. It has three poles that it will be standing on. It didn't have that big base. So where do they get that base from? There's a lot of speculation. I've heard some deals with it. And of course, let me just mention it. But for those who don't know, the menorah in Rome, and not just the menorah in Rome, we have lots of images of the menorah from when the menorah existed, and from a generation or two afterwards. We have it on graves. We have numerous examples of it, and they all are curved. Take a look at the Arch of Titus. You see the curved menorah. However, the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnah has a drawing there. It's not clear whether he meant to draw it artistically or he just was drawing it, although his son thought it was an artistic, an actual drawing, but in which there's straight. And because of that, the Lubavitcher Rebbe got this whole thing that therefore it's straight. Now, the Rambam lived 1,000 years after the menorah. He had no idea what the menorah looked like. Now we know what the menorah looked like. There's no doubt about it. It's not straight. And yet you can't convince any Chabadnik. And that's why, in case you're wondering, every one of these Chabad menorahs, giant menorahs, small menorahs, they're all with the straight arms. And it's not an accident. It's because the Rebbe said, this is the Rambam's position. We have to hold the Rambam's position. Now you could show them. You could show them a video if we had it from Second Temple days. It wouldn't change their mind. They won't. That's the menorah, but it's not correct. It's not the way the menorah looked. And I only mention it because this time of year, we see these menorahs everywhere you go. And but we know what the menorah looked like. So in this tshuva, however, on page 151, he quotes something that Ben Tzvi, it's like Ben Tzvi, president of the state of Israel, tells him that in the days of Shmuel Salant, when the Bezalel school was opened in Jerusalem, there were people who argued and said, how can you do that? You know, this isn't the Jewish way. And Shmuel Salant was asked about sculptures. And according to what Ben Tzvi reports, it's hard to believe, but this is what Rav Shmuel Salant said. Rav Shmuel Salant said that in the sculptures, which they make sculptures of people, are they actual complete sculptures? That is, do they include sexual organs? And the answer is no. And then he says, he didn't want to get involved. He says, I don't need to protest because the goof is not shalim. And Reflex says, what's going on here? Granted, you have the Roman or Greek statues when the statues are nude. But does this mean, Reflex says, that you can have a statue of the emperor? And because the emperor has clothes on. So there's no sex organs under the clothes, that would be permissible? Reflex doesn't see this at all. He says that that wouldn't make any sense. But that's what he quotes Rav Shmuel Salant saying. And according to this, at least after the fact, a statue of a person, a dressed person, that wouldn't be an issue. It wouldn't be a problem. And I'd feel better if it wasn't Ben Tzvi, because someone like Ben Tzvi doesn't have what we call nemonos. You know, at the end of the day, you can't trust Ben Tzvi to tell you if something's kosher. So you couldn't rely on something Ben Tzvi tells you to say, well, this is Rav Shmuel Salant's position. If it was someone like Rav Shlomo David Kahana who told you that this is Rav Shmuel Salant, then that's a different situation. But I wouldn't, you can't give him nemonos. And finally, the last thing I want to mention is, two more things. Thank you, Daniel. Apparently I spoke incorrectly, maybe speaking fast. I said that about Frankel, how do you pronounce the word, is it Mishnah or Mishneh? I think I might have said he brought a proof that we say Mishnayos. And therefore, Daniel says, but wait a second, it's Mikveh, we say Mikvos. If I said that, I didn't mean to say that. What he said is, he says Mishnah Seinu. When we say Mishnah Seinu, that's the proof. That is, we don't say in the construct, we say Mishnat. And we don't say Mishneh. So that's how he says we know it should be pronounced Mishnah. By the way, in terms of grammar, those of you who are interested, and I know we have a few of you, check it out. Figure it out maybe on the way when I come back after my trip. We can talk about it. Look at Ma'osor. Ma'osor Yeshua Siochan El Shabeach. Tikon. We say tikon. We put the emphasis on the first syllable in the song, but tikon beit tefilati. How is it tikon? We know that beit, bayit, is a masculine word, and yet it has here tikon. So figure it out. Send me your answers, and it should be yikon. And if you look in Art Scroll and Birnbaum, they don't translate. That's a nifal. It's passive. They translate it. They don't know what to do with it. So they translate as tikon beit tefilati as like second person singular that you should establish. But that's not what it is. It's not an active verb. It's a passive verb. And it's a third person imperfect nifal. And it's tikon. So figure it out, and we'll get back to that. And one more thing, since I'm on it, I'll mention
Rabbi, bet
tefillah. Hold on, wait to the end. Type it in. Hold on, don't wait. I want to finish this, and then we'll come back to it later. And take a look in this week's Parsha. I'm told you have the wife of Yosef, Bidrash, the daughter of Dina, Asnat. I'm told that in Israel, they pronounce this like a kamatz katan, osnat. Israelis, you can testify to that if that's the case, osnat. It's not. It's not osnat. It's a kamatz gadol. It's asnat. It's the same like safnat. It's not safnat. It's safnat, and it's asnat. Asnat, actually. Yeah. Okay, everyone. Let us get back to where we are now. And I'll take and hold on to the end if anyone had a question on give the answer to Tikon. But I want to get right to where we're going because we have important stuff to do today. If you recall, the class before that, we're dealing all the controversy of the Darchei Mishnah. So that's where we're going to go to now. The last thing we dealt with, I think, was Frankel talking about his interpretations of the Mishnah not in line with the Gemara. But that's not the major problem, although we saw Hirsch expressed opposition to that. Incidentally, with regard to that, I thank Yekusiel Geli. I did not know this at all. There's a Rosh Yeshiva in New York, the son of Rav Shlomo Drillman. He was a Rosh Yeshiva at YU. His name is Rav Yaakov Drillman. I think he's in Novartik, or he was in Novartik. he has a whole approach to learning, which I didn't know. And let me just read you what Lucille says. One surprise, and then he sent it to me. I looked at it. He has a whole kuntras. It's called Kuntras Mishnas Rav Meir. That's in Rav Drillman's Yad Shlomo. This is what Yekusiel writes. One surprising proponent to the Frankelian approach not mentioned is a contemporary Haredi Rosh Hashiva, Rav Yankel Drillman. He's developed an entire methodology of providing independent explanations of Mishnayos. His argument is that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi edited Rav Meir's version of the Mishnah, as embodied in the well-known principle Stam Mishnah Kerav Meir. His preferred method was to modify it as little as possible. Therefore, if the halacha did not follow Rav Meir on a specific issue, he would nevertheless maintain the language if there was some forced interpretation whereby the Mishnah could be read in line with halacha. Thus, the Gemara's common dichukim and nukimtot are aimed at finding the way to make the Mishnah comply with halacha, while Rav Drillman's own endeavors are to explain the pshat of the Mishnah as Rav Meir intended, even though they run contrary to the Gemara and are therefore non-halachic. And I have to tell you, I read through some of this Kuntras Mishnas Rav Meir, and if I didn't know it was a Haredi Rosh Yeshiva, I would have thought I'm reading Rav Yosef C. Dunner or Halivni or Zachariah Frankel. And thank you, Yekusiel. This shocks me that that anyone, as a matter of a shita, is doing this. But I should not be shocked anymore, because I've learned enough not to be shocked. But wait till you hear some of the things I'll tell you today, those whose only education is from the yeshivas. Okay, so now we come to, I guess, a major point. How did Frankel reply? He was attacked for denying Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, saying that it all is from the ancient rabbis. He was also attacked for denying the hermeneutical principles. They're both, as denying they go back to Sinai. Both of these are central features of the attack, but historically people seem to put the stress on Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. We're going to come back to both of them in a few minutes. I want to read you now Frankel's reply. I mean, here you have a whole polemic. In his attacking him, and also defenses of him by different people, and the main protagonist, Frankel, he stays above it. He stays out of it. He responds in a very short way fashion in his journal, and he says as follows. I'm just going to summarize for you. Well, I'll read it to you, how Frankel defends himself. And he says as follows, and I'll just summarize into English what he says here. He says that my book, Darchei Mishnah, people have attacked it in an inappropriate way, in a way that we haven't seen any such attacks in Jewish literature. That's a bit of an exaggeration, I think, but that's what he says. He says, my sense of kavod, of honor, does not allow me to get involved in the back and forth. He's saying basically that Hirsch insulted me and Fisher, they treated me like I'm a nobody, so I'm not going to dignify it with a reply. Mm-hmm. Especially, this would have been especially hurtful if it's true, as what Yitzhak Heinemann reports, that he was told by someone who was in a position to know that before Frankel published Darchei Mishnah, he was on good terms with Hirsch, and Hirsch even once stayed in Dresden an extra night just so he would have an opportunity to talk with, to schmooze with Frankel. He continues, in clear words, I can only say that one who reads my book without a preconceived notion will not find any evidence for all the attacks against me. The one who searches hearts, namely God, will know, and he's the witness, that when I wrote this book, I had absolutely no intention of undermining any Jewish dogmas. The point of this book, and my intention is clear to everyone, that is to analyze the Mishnah, show the wisdom in the Mishnah. In every page, you can see my great respect for the Torah Shebaal Peh, for the rabbis. And you're going to tell me what my opponents say, that my entire work was to undermine Torah? Impossible. He says, anyone who does not have any preconceived notions we'll see that the point of the book, as I said, to study the Mishnah, how it was written, the order of it, and with regard to the tradition and Torah Shebaal Peh, where I said that no scholar can speak against and lessen its significance, and regarding the foundations of Jewish faith, the principles of faith, I did not speak in the book at all about this. The book is about the Mishnah, how the Mishnah was written, about the different rabbis. It's a technical book to a certain extent. I did not get into principles of faith. He says, from the standpoint of this book, all I needed to do was to show that there's an ancient tradition, but I'm not getting involved in how ancient, because that's not the point of what I'm trying to do. And he says, I've done this before in my other book that dealt with the Septuagint. You know, we start with the assumption that there's an ancient Torah Shebaal Peh, and then I deal with what the rabbis did with it. But I'm not getting into the nitty gritty over when did it begin. That's a different book. And then he says, and I didn't talk about, he says, and I didn't want to speak about principles of faith. And I didn't get into the issues of Halacha Moshe Mesinai, especially, says, since the number of Halacha Moshe Mesinai, what actually qualifies as Halacha Moshe Mesinai, has not yet been determined. And there's all sorts of disputes about this. And he says, I precisely didn't want to get involved in that issue. And that's why I quoted the Rush, because everyone, even the opponents of the Torah Shebaal Peh, will agree with the Rush that we're dealing with an ancient practice, but I didn't want to get involved in the details. And after all this, he says, my whole idea was to try to get a new approach in the study of the Mishnah. And he says, I understand that maybe it's written in a certain way that people didn't, they misunderstood. But I'm not going to dignify the attacks against me. And he ends by quoting a pasuk in Tehillim that those who curse, they'll be cursed and you'll be blessed, namely about himself. And that's all he says. Now, well, this statement as well did not stop the controversy, because it is not an explicit acknowledgement that he believes in Torah Shebaal Peh, in Halacha Moshe Mesinai, that literally goes back to Sinai. What he says is that the purpose of my book was not to involve myself with this, and there's disputes about Halacha Moshe Mesinai, and I wasn't interested in establishing Ikare Emunah. Okay, but again, even in the response, look, you have to admire him because he will not say something that's false. He just avoids it, but he doesn't, and at least that's the implication, that he could have just said, you're all attacking me, so let me tell you, of course I believe it. He doesn't say that. Well, Hirsch blasts this statement as well. Hirsch says as follows. You can see this in the collected writings of Hirsch, page 309. This is all, Hirsch's response is called On Dr. Frankel's Statement. And he says, he does not deny Mesorah, the process of transmission, but he does deny Kabbalah, the manner in which it was originally received, the idea that Moshe Kibbal Torah Misinai. He says that he considers the Mesorah as literal truth only beginning with Halachic Knesset Hagdolah. So Hirsch says, here we have Frankel's statement, and again, he cannot tell us that Halacha Moshe Misinai is literal. He goes on and says that if all we have from Kadosh Baruch Hu is the written law, and everything else is from the sages, he says there would be no reason for us to accept as authoritative the exegesis and interpretations of such authorities as Ezra, the Anshei Knesset Gadolah, or Hillel. We could, just like those earlier authorities, sit down and interpret the law in accordance with our own views and consider our interpretations binding on our own generation. Hirsch says, basically, if there's no Torah Shebaal Peh that goes all the way back, Halacha Moshe Mesinai, to Moshe, then why should we follow the rabbis? This, I have to say, I don't understand at all, because we're going to see that there's plenty of Rishonim, Achronim, who are minimalists. You look in the Gemara, they'll tell you that all of these drashot are just from the rabbis. They're not Halacha Moshe Mesinai. So what's Hirsch saying? Why are we bound to those? I mean, it's... from Frankl's perspective, the Torah gives the authority to the rabbis, and we're bound to the rabbis. And for him, the fact that if he says, oh, it doesn't really matter if it goes all the way back. He's a believer in the sages, such a believer in the sages that he doesn't need it to be literally true. You could see that as very pious, perhaps. But so I don't get Hirsch's point here at all. And then listen to what Hirsch says. Not only does the methodological introduction, that is Frankl in his book, not say a word about the divine revelation of the oral law and the divine origin of the midot of interpretation and inquiry, it teaches the exact opposite. And then it goes on and on. So everything is set. You now have two sides. You have the positive historical school. You have what becomes orthodoxy. We'll see no orthodox spokesman really got behind Frankl in the way we're understanding it now. Even Scheer, Shlomo Yehuda Rapoport, who defends him by stating that, but Frankl must accept that basic Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai exists, even if he didn't mention it. So that's where we stand. I have to add, before I show you Frankl's final statement on this with Kut, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to have to read you Frankl's final statement now because I have a lot of things I want to get into, but we're not going to get to Frankl's final statement. I have a special request before the break, get to the final statement. But then we're going to go back and because I want to get into the nitty gritty here. Is Gezer Shava? Is that an Ikar Amuna that goes back to Sinai and that Frankl's being attacked? And what about Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai? But so I want to now read you something else. So let's skip ahead 8 years later. And this is what to make of this. That's the question. 8 years after Darkei HaMishnah appears, Frankl publishes Hosafot U'Mafteach Darkei HaMishnah in 1867. He publishes additional notes a Mafteach, an index, the Darkei HaMishnah. And right at the beginning of the first page of the Hosafot, Frankl comments on the following passage. If you remember, in Darkei HaMishnah, he says as follows. After saying that you have in the Gemara, Harbei Pamim, many times it mentions Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, and the Rambam in the introduction to Seder Zeroyim brings a number of places Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, and regarding Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, see the Rush in Hilchos Mikvaos. And the Rush says it's not to be taken. In that example, he says Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai doesn't always mean it's to be taken literally. In his Hosafot, he doesn't make a big announcement. He just adds like as a note. He says as follows. On this passage, he says, see Shelsur's Chavasiar, see the Chavasiar. It's a famous Chavasiar, Rayar Chaim Bachrach. Of worms, because the Rambam says that Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai are never disputed. And the Chavos Yair is a long tshuva saying, what are you talking about? We have plenty of examples where they're disputed. I think the implication is the Rambam doesn't think those are really Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. But then he says as follows. Listen to this. The Inyan Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. Hu kemashma'o shenemar Moshe Mi-Sinai. The idea of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai is literal, that it was given to Moshe at Sinai. But sometimes when it says it's not to be taken literally. What you have here is a completely orthodox statement from Frankl. A statement that could have been said 8 years prior, that could have been said into the response, that's something that he doesn't make an announcement. He's not even doing it to defend himself. This is 8 years after the fact. This is there's no more dispute. Frankl is now head of his own school of thought, and then as the Orthodox, he doesn't need to defend himself. There's no more dispute. And yet he says it. He throws it in that basically the whole dispute was about my view of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. I believe in Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, but sometimes it's not literal. Now, some people have said that, well, he wrote this for apologetic reasons. He couldn't really believe it. But what are the apologetic reasons? He doesn't make an announcement. This is like a long time after the dispute is over with. He doesn't need to defend himself to anyone anymore. He's now out of orthodoxy. And this is, he doesn't make a big announcement. He just throws this in a little note in the back. So what do you make of this? It's a mystery. Because it goes against, actually, if you read the Darchei Mishnah, that's not the implication of it. It's not in contradiction to it, but it's not really the implication, and that's not the way people have understood it. But here you have him explicitly saying this. And he's not afraid of the Orthodox. He doesn't need to be afraid of them. He's running his own community now, and he's not trying to get into their good graces, but he writes it. So aren't we to assume he believes it? I think so. Why else would he write it? And that takes us back to his statement of clarification. He doesn't want to get into the gutter with Hirsch and Fisher and defend himself. And he simply says that I've never meant to undermine Ikarei Emunah. And he doesn't speak about this matter. But then when he makes his posafot, he includes this and he clarifies in case there was some misunderstanding. This is what I believe. There you have it. You don't want to believe him? Don't believe him. But this is what he says. I'll read it again. Incredible. Had he said as much during the controversy, there wouldn't have been a controversy. I guess they could have attacked him over the Gezeirah Shavah and other things, but that's not so clear. Wait till you see one of the Gedolei Yisrael, like I mentioned in a few minutes, that Hirsch also would have attacked him as being an apikoros. But that's Frankel. So, and a lot of people don't know about this Hosafot. It's mentioned in a few places. It's mentioned in Shaul Pinchas Rabinowitz's biography of Frankel. But it's not mentioned in any of the scholarship, really, that discusses Frankel's opinion. They don't know because it's in an out-of-the-way place. It's mentioned by Shaul Pinchas Rabinowitz, and I saw that Rabbi Schachter from Belfast, we spoke about. He's the rabbi, if you remember, who Beryl Wine thought he was in his Beryl Wine's book. He has a picture of him saying he's Rabbi Shaul Salanter. And Rivero said that when you look at him, you sense the holiness. But it's not Rabbi Shaul Salanter. It's Rabbi Schachter of Belfast. I showed the picture before. I could show it again if you want. Also, take a look at Schneer Weinman's post on the Svernblog a few months ago. But in his book, he has an essay on Frankel. And he cites this as well. And that really koshers Frankel. That sort of then puts him in the Orthodox camp, I think you have to say. And that helps us understand a bit why you do have a number of Gedolei Yisrael, I've mentioned them already, who did not see Frankel as out of the fold. And if you're going to say, Halacha Moshe Sinai, this is what he says. In the end, what's the expression in Hebrew? Sof tov or kol tov. All's well in the end, right? He says he acknowledges Halacha Moshe Sinai. So I mentioned that for the request I had. I didn't want to leave you hanging for 5 weeks without it. But now I want to go back, say a few things. First of all, Frankel says in this comment, in response to the controversy, that he didn't really get into, he didn't just deal with Ikarei Emunah, he wasn't dealing with theology. It's not exactly 100% accurate because although he doesn't deal with Ikarei Emunah, he does deal with, we'll find plenty of theological content. I mean, he makes it seem as if the whole point of it is to examine the Mishnah and not to deal with theology. But he has a few sections where he does. I'll just give you some examples. And this actually, I saw some of these myself, not all of them, but there's someone I don't know at NYU named Daniel Mackler. And just last year, he came out with an article. Here it is. The place of Maimonides and Zachariah Frankel's Darchei Mishnah. It was like Hashkacha Pratis that it just came out. And in this article, he mentions a number of examples which are helpful. So, for instance, on page 65 in his article, he quotes how Frankel deals with the Jews of Alexandria. And how they ended up losing Torah Judaism because they aligned with Greek wisdom. And that's not dealing with the Mishnah. That's like a theological statement. Also, he points out, this I myself had already seen, but he points out how Frankel, just as an aside, mentions the Rambam and his Tamei HaMitzvot, his reasons for the mitzvot. And he says that the whole point for these reasons was to basically give a satisfying reason for those who are engaged in philosophy. But it wasn't his, in other words, the Rambam didn't really buy these reasons. As Daniel Mackler says, instead of being the preeminent Jewish medieval philosopher in the Greek tradition, Frankel's Maimonides becomes medieval Jewish philosophy's most subtle opponent. And in other words, he argues, just like you find people like the Minchas Elazar or Munkach and others who say that the reasons the Rambam gives for the commandments, those were just to satisfy those Jews who were interested in philosophy, but didn't really reflect his own thinking. That's an interesting perspective. That's better maybe than saying, like, as so many have said, that we don't like these reasons. They don't satisfy us. Or Soloveitchik wasn't satisfied by the reasons. But there's a whole tradition in the Hasidic world in particular to see these reasons as not really reflecting the Rambam's authentic reasons, but just a way to satisfy those who needed something. Mackler calls attention to a couple other examples. I like the end of his article, where he talks about why did it create such a controversy, Frankel's position. There was other people saying similar things. Krochmo, for instance, Ranak, Nachum Berkel says basically the same thing. And what Mackler argues is that it was the first book that Frankel wrote after the founding of the Jewish Theological Seminary at Breslau. He was newly powerful in the Jewish community and stood in a position to influence the Jewish teachers of the next generation. So Mackler argues that it's basically because of Frankel's position in the community as a teacher, of head of a rabbinical seminary, one who's going to be sending rabbis out. And that makes perfect sense. And like Hirsch himself says, he says it not, and also Fisher, they say, Frankel, who's training rabbis, what is he teaching them? If this is what he writes in Darchei HaMishnah, can you imagine what he's teaching them? So that really is why it became such a controversy. I spoke about Hirsch's attack and Gottlieb Fischer's attack. There were a few other attacks. One of them, we have descendants of him listening here, so I'll just mention Rav Shlomo Zev Klein. He wrote a book called Mipnei Kosh, and it's reprinted in a book called Azamar Shlomo. And it's dignified, unlike Hirsch's writing, and Fisher, he treats Frankel with greater respect, but it's a strong critique of, and he picks up on the same points we've seen. I want to read you something, though, and then ask you, is this really so clear, so pushed, as we say in yeshivas? So here is on, from, Rabbi Koy, who was a rabbi in France and has many, many descendants. He quotes Frankel right at the beginning of Darchei HaMishnah, where Frankel says, you know, you have these great rabbis who taught the people Torah. They are the ones who had to explain the mitzvot. Kegon asher karo apasuk ayin tachat ayin, pirshu am shena kavana ayin tachat ayin mamash. They explain to the people that ayin tachat ayin is not to be taken literally. And then what it says that you take on the first day, creates Hadar, they explain that it's an etrog, etc. Might sound unproblematic to you, but Rabbi Klein says, what do you mean? That they explain that ayin tachat ayin is not to be taken literally, and they explain that it creates Hadar is an etrog? What problem did you find, Frankel, in the words of the Rambam, who says in the introduction to the Mishnah, that all these things, ayin tachat ayin, creates Hadar as an etrog, that these are all halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. And again, so Rabbi Klein goes on to say, obviously we see here, Frankel denies it. He denies that ayin tachat ayin is Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. He says it that this is something the early sages developed, and also that the Priyat Sadar is an etrog. And I think if you would go into a typical yeshiva today and repeat this, they would say the exact same thing, that by definition, it's an Ikar Emunah, that Ayin Tachat Ayin was always to be understood as monetary. And if you say otherwise, you're a heretic. After all, doesn't the Rambam say that explicitly? Even though there is an opinion in the Gemara that seems to take it literally, and also creates Hadar, referring to an Esrog, the Talmud tries to derive how you know it's an Esrog, not something else. From the Rambam's perspective, this is only to try to find, let's say, an Asmachta. It's not actually creating the law. The law is known by tradition. It's just trying to create an Asmachta, just trying to establish it. But is that the only approach? I have to tell you that there are sources, a number of sources, that actually say that Ayin Tachas Ayin is from the sages. That is, it's not like the Rambam says. Josephus, actually, he says that you had the option. You could either do Ayin Tachas Ayin literally if you wanted, or you can get monetary payment. But there are traditional sources that say that Ayin Tachas Ayin is something, it's a drasha of Chazal, that they had the power, and it's not Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. In fact, there is today, as we speak, a Rosh Yeshiva in Israel. His name is, a student of Rav Moshe Shapiro, his name is Rav Eliyahu Meir Feivelson. If you know the name Feivelson, you know it's important yichus. He's involved in what's something called Beis Medrash HaGra. A huge controversy broke out in the Haredi world about 3 years ago, but the controversy, it didn't affect him. And I'll just read you, and you can look on his Wikipedia page. He... Saviv Mishnah Toshar Feivelson Hitarer Pumus. Around the teachings of Feivelson, a controversy arose. In a shiur he gave in 2019, he said that there's no kafira in saying that the sages, the Lo Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, Heim Shechidshu at the Parshanut Achivayin Tachadayin, Hamotzi Ota Mipshuto, that the sages were the ones with the power given to them who created the drasha of Ayin Tachadayin not being literal. And that's part of the authority they have that the Torah gave them. And then it goes on in the Wikipedia article that just led to attack on him, especially from David Cohen, the Rosh Yeshiva Chevron. And it says, because of this criticism, he gave another shiur explaining his position. And I listened to the shiur that he explains his position. He doesn't retract it. He just explains it. And he's like center in the Haredi world. And we have other sources as well that say that. I want to read you something from Rav Shlomo Luria, the Amshal Shlomo. And the Amshal Shlomo says, and he says this about Ayin Tachat Ayin, where the Rambam says that the idea that it's a mamon is always a tradition. This is the Yamshal Shlomo. You'll find this in his commentary on Bava Kama, chapter 8, Siman 1, Aleph. V'hinei kosov HaRambam. The Rambam said what we said. V'af al pi shedvarim elu mi'nirin mi'inyan Torah shebichsav kuwa mefaroshim hei mipi Moshe Rabbeinu avashal mahar Sinai, etc. This is what the Yamshal Shlomo says. V'lo hevanti devarav. I don't understand the Rambam's position. He says that we have many gezeros shavos and many times when the rabbanan are darshan it. Why do we need a kabbalah ish mi pi ish? The Amshal Shlomo doesn't see that you need this ish mi pi ish. That is the Rambam's position. But you have others, Rabbi Glasner in the Dor Ravi and others, who do not see this as Ayin Tachat Ayin, as an Ikar Emunah, that this is something that goes back, as Rav Feivelson develops. Rav Feivelson's idea is that the Torah leaders, the Jewish leaders, affect their era. and the Torah gives them the authority. And in ancient times, Ayin Tachasayin was thought to be acceptable, so they allowed that. But in later generations, they changed it because they have that authority. By the way, if you look in the Mor Nevuchim seems to imply that differently than what he writes in the Mishnah Torah, because he talks about Ayin Tachasayin. He says, "I'm going to explain the pasuk al pi pshat." Not al pi drash, and on the spot there, I think it's Shem Tov, the commentary says, "What do you mean al pi pshat, not the drash? The pshat is that it's monetary. How could the Rambam say otherwise?" So there are those who think that the Rambam's secret position is what he implies in the guide, that it is monetary, that it's not monetary originally, that's a drash of Chazal. And as far as I know, the Fivel Sin hasn't been thrown out, considered a heretic. So I think Frankel could have made that argument. Now, what about Pri Etz Hadar? Well, as I said, the Rambam's position is that this is there's never any doubt of what the Pri Etz Hadar is. When you look in the Gemara and Masechta Sukkah, it's only about finding a scriptural support. But there are many others who disagree with this. Look in the Pnei Yeshua, for instance. He explains that contrary to the Rambam, the Gemara really does raise the possibility that Pri Etz Hadar need not mean an Esrog, or only an Esrog. And let me raise this question to you. Let's say it's conclusively shown, conclusively, that the Esrog we use only came to the Near East many generations after Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's say we can show that it comes from China, and it only came to the Near East many years after Moshe. Well, then we would be forced to conclude that it's not a law, Halacha Moshe Sinai. By the way, this would not remove it from the status of Torah law, I think, according to those who disagree with the Rambam. Remember, the Rambam, those who disagree with the Rambam, with the Ramban, they think that something derives from a drasha, if it's a real drasha, is Torah law. The Rambam doesn't see it as having the status of Torah law. So as long as the sages derive Pri Etz Hadar as the Esrog, then it can very well have the status of Doraisa as other fruits. Now, in terms of where the Esrog comes from, there's this book I call your attention to. It's actually a Wayu Musmach, Rabbi David Master. Etrog, How a Chinese Fruit Became a Jewish Symbol. And the whole point of the book is from this Wayu Musmach, is that Esrog comes from China, and it only comes later, way after Moshe Rabbeinu, into Eretz Yisrael. Incidentally, I'm having something come out in their house, which is going to deal with you. I have all the sources for this. Mosada Rav Kook even published a book which includes these ideas. Yehuda Felix, who's the great botanist and Talmudic and biblical fruits and vegetables and all that, he rejects this approach. He argues, based on scholarship, not on dogma, that the Pri Etz Hadar was always identified with the Esrog. But here you have an argument. So my question is, if it's proven authoritatively that Master's position is correct, so what are we going to do? Well, then we'll have to conclude that it's not a Lachamo Shemi Sinai. We'll have to conclude it's that the Rambam's wrong. It's like other... And, you know, there's people who disagree with the Rambam on this. That's why when Rabbi Klein attacks Frankel for mentioning Pri Etz Hadar, Frankel could have replied that who says we're all bound by the Rambam's position? Jacob Reifman, big Torah scholar, but not one of the Rabbanim. He's like one of the Frum Maskilim, but he knew everything and was very close with a number of the Rabbanim. He writes how he argues that in medieval times, even fruits other than the Esrog were used to fulfill the mitzvah. So now this might seem like an unorthodox suggestion, but none other than Rav Shlomo Eliezer Alfandari. He's known as Saba Kadisha, one of the greatest Sephardic Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael in the 20th century. And in his Tshuvas, he agrees with Reifman. And he says that in ancient times, that is in Bayit Sheni, Tshuvas Bayit Sheni, no distinction was made between an esrog and a lemon was also used to fulfill the mitzvah. This is the Saba Kadisha. So he's not denying that an esrog is a Pri Etz Hadar, but he's saying that contrary to the Rambam, that's not the only Pri Etz Hadar. Other Pri Etz Hadars also, and a lemon's a Pri Etz Hadar. Rabbi, some of you might know the name of Michael Abraham, Chal Avraham. brilliant guy in Israel, as a physicist and a Talmud Chacham. He has a very popular website in which he engages with people back and forth. So I found on his website, he was asked this very question. What if evidence is found that the Esrog did not reach the Near Eastern days of Moshe? Does that create a religious problem? And he replies, absolutely not. The only important point for us is the Talmudic identification of Priyat Hadar. The historical record, he says, has no relevance in this matter. We follow Chazal. We're rabbinic Jews. Chazal tells us the Priyat Hadar is an Esrog. By the way, in Masechta Sukkah, Chazal don't say that this is Halacha Moshe Sinai, like they do in other things. That's the Rambam saying it. And you'll see in my article in Lair House, I cite a number of examples, including Rav Yehuda Amital. Rav Amital says that he cites one of the Acharonim, and that seems to be the position he holds, that Priyat Hadar is any fruit that satisfies the characteristics. Esrog is only one, but there's other fruits as well. So I try to, well, you'll see why I get, it's really a tangent I get brought into about history. The issue is whether history can affect halachic decision making. And the Chazon Ish has a position on this, and most of the time it's only theoretical, because history, we decide halacha based on halachic sources. History doesn't really have a role to play on it. But there are some times when evidence could be brought in, brought to bear. By the way, since I mentioned Esrog, let me mention one other thing that I point out in that article. Chabad has an interesting tradition. Chabad, of course, follows the Rambam. In this, even before the Lubavitcher Rebbe, they held to this. So, but if you know Chabad, where they get their Esrogim from, they get them from Calabria in Italy. So, how did that get to the Midbar? Well, the tradition in Chabad is that Moshe Rabbeinu sent messengers, malachim, but real malachim, that is angels, and they went to by the clouds of glory, brought them to Italy, and then they got the Esrogim and brought them back. They asked a leading figure in Chabad, who I can ask about this, because most Chabadniks I couldn't ask, but I asked him, in Chabad, do they take this literally? Angels went to Italy and brought it back, and he said that some see it, do not take it literally. They see this as symbolic, he said, but others take it absolutely literally. If you can believe in one miracle, you can believe in another miracle. Rav Yashav, in his notes on Masechta Sukkah, completely rejects this. He says this is impossible. It can't be that he doesn't accept this at all. I want to end let me just end with one more point, and then that'll be a good spot to end. So when we can pick up, we can come back and we'll deal with Gezeirah Shavah and other things. Because I was going to tell you, wait till you hear what I tell you about Gezeirah Shavah, but it'll give you something to look forward to. But I want to show you something I found in the Rav. And I think it's interesting, dealing with this very point of, because the Rav is also following the Rambam, that the Esrog is a tradition, not something that Chazal came up with their authority. But I remember when you say Chazal came up with their authority, like the opinions of the Saba Kaddish and others, what it means is that Priyat Hadar could encompass a variety of fruits, and Chazal say the Esrog is one of them. This doesn't mean that there aren't others. And this doesn't mean that the Saba Kaddisha isn't talking about how far back this goes. He probably thought it went back to the beginning, but he also says it's not only the Esrog, it could be other fruits, and he specifically mentions the lemon. He thinks the lemon is a kosher, you can make the bracha on the lemon. But if you recall in Masechta Sukkah, it's actually on Memches Amud Beis. In both the Mishnah and the Braisa there's a story about the Sadducee. A lot of the Kohanim in those days were Sadducees, and that you have the water libation, and he poured it over his feet instead of pouring it on the altar like he's supposed to. And so what did the people do? The people pelted him with their esrogim. That's what it describes. They pelted him with their esrogim. If I'm not mistaken, one of the versions, maybe it's... It says they killed him with it. Maybe the Yerushalmi, I forget now. So the Rav Soloveitchik mentions in Shir that why did they throw their esrogim at him? It's because the laws, the Arba Minim, that they depend on Torah Shebaal Peh. How do we know what an esrog is? We know because of Torah Shebaal Peh. And since the Sadducee was rejecting Torah Shebaal Peh with the water libation, Therefore, they threw their esrogim at them because the esrog also depends on Torah Shabbat. You know, I shouldn't assume that the Rav in this comment is necessarily agreeing, saying that you have to agree with the Rambam's position, because Torah Shel HaPeh doesn't just mean all the way back to Sinai. If the sages, if Ezra and his base decide that the Esrog is Pre-Etz Hadar, one of the things that can be Pre-Etz Hadar, that's also Torah Shel HaPeh. Remember, the Sadducees rejected everything from our tradition. That went back to that we regard as Torah Shabbat. So I take back what I said, that maybe it's in the clean identification with the Rambam. So why did I mention this? Because there's a book of criticisms on the Rav's Chidushim. And I first learned of what the Rav said through this other book. Now I see it's published in Rabbi Rechman's edition of the Rishim Oshirim of Saul of Egypt. There was a rabbi named Rabbi Altusky. I think he's the son-in-law of Rabbi Scheinberg, if I'm not mistaken. His father was a rabbi in the Bronx. I believe his father gave Ashkacha on Hebrew National years ago. But Rabbi Altusky has a series of svarim on called Chidushi HaMazbir. Who's the Mazbir? He doesn't mention Chas Hashem to mention Rav Soloveitchik's name. So Rav Soloveitchik is called the Mazbir. He has Rabbi Altusky, a big Talmud Chacham. He has commentaries on many of the Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva's Chidushim. And of course, he mentions who they are. I don't remember offhand now, but a lot of the famous, the classic works. So that, but the Mazbir, these were, I think, Rav Schechter's notes that had been passed around for many years. So in a number of Masechtas, and page after page, he attacks the Rav's understanding. And so he gets to this point as well in Sukkah, and he says as follows. He says, the Rav's position doesn't make any sense. Why? He says, because what was going on here in the Beis HaMikdash, Kol Yisrael was there. You didn't just have the Talmid HaChamim, you had the masses also, the Hamonam. And the way the Rav describes it, that because, you know, the Sadducee, by not doing the wood elevation properly, is rejecting Torah Shabbat Peh. Therefore, the Jews picked up their esrogim, and the esrog also represents Torah Shabbat Peh, and Dafka, that's what they decided to stone them with, as opposed to, let's say, picking up an axe or whatever. And Rabbi Tusky says, basically says, what nonsense. These were Amaratzim. These were not just Talmid Chachamim. They didn't know, and they weren't thinking in terms of Torah Shabbat Peh. They saw that the Sadducee was doing the improper thing, and they just took what was in their hand and threw it at the Sadducee. Now, I have to say, with all due respect to Rav Altusky, I find it hard to believe that the Rav was actually offering an actual historical explanation and was offering that. I think it's pretty clear that the Rav's comment is made in a homiletical vein, that here the Sadducee rejects Torah Shabbat Peh, so the people with the esrogim represent Torah Shabbat, throw it at it. So for Altusky to say that, what are you talking about, Rav Soloveitchik? You think the Amoratzim there, who are doing the, you know, with their Ulev and esrogim, you think they can make a connection to Torah Shabbat Peh and the esrog? No, they just picked those in their hand. They're arguing on two different levels. The Rav is, I'm certain the Rav is not arguing historically here. And so I think Rabbi Altusky's criticism is really off the mark here. Okay, we have what I want to do when we come back is I want to speak about Gezeira Shava, because that's the other point that, he doesn't respond. He doesn't have an Osafa on Gezeira Shava, the hermeneutical principles. Is there an Ikar Amunah that Gezeira Shava, and if so, all Gezeira Shavas, a few Gezeira Shavas, that they also have to be regarded as Misinai? That's what Rashi says, 100%. But are there other voices in the tradition that Frankel could have looked to? Wait till you hear what I'm going to show you from one of the big rabbis. I think you'll be surprised. And then really just some other things I want to get into a little bit about Israel Hildesheimer. We saw Hirsch's attitude. Hildesheimer is more open-minded. Hildesheimer is more sympathetic to academic scholarship. Hildesheimer also opposes Frankel, almost to the extent of Hirsch, a little bit more understanding. And Hildesheimer, you'll see it's more complicated with Hildesheimer, though. So we'll see that. And then I just a few more points, interesting points of Frankel that I want to call your attention to. And really, then we'll wrap it up. I think maybe two more classes. But let me, we couldn't do it before the break. So let me read some of the comments. Someone says about Ben Tzvi, we can't rely on him to tell you if something is kosher, and therefore I said you can't rely on him halacha l'maisa to cite Rav Shmuel Salant. And from the chief rabbis in Israel on down, can rely on them to say if something is ethical or not. Okay, that's a political comment. I don't know. I think I'll pass on that. I can tell you that the previous chief rabbi, Ashkenazic chief rabbi, definitely did not have a cheskas kashrus. I think the current chief rabbis do have a cheskas kashrus, and I think that for the most part they are ethical and they're doing the right thing. You might disagree with some of their opinions and see it maybe as too extreme, but I have respect. One of them is definitely a great posek and one of the posek gedol Yisrael, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, and the Ashkenazic chief rabbi. As far as I know, he's only made a Kiddush Hashem. He hasn't made Chil Hashem, as far as I know. Okay. So Morris Firestein has an article in Modern Judaism that explains the relation of the Maimonidean menorah to Chabad Messianism. I have to say that I had forgotten about that article. I know in Stephen Fine's book on the menorah, he thinks that the Chabad stress on the menorah is an anti-Zionist thing.
No,
State of Israel identified it, therefore he, but I never believed in that.
He's wrong.
Everyone should look at Morris's article. You want to say something, Morris? I think it's absolutely nonsense.
Completely wrong. He knows nothing about Chabad. Most people who write about this don't know about Chabad. I had the pleasure of learning in Talmud Chetamimim, so I got it straight from the horse's mouth. Bekitzer, the menorah starts in 1982. Somebody asked, what's the proof that Chabad, you know, et cetera. If you look at the public Chabad menorahs before 1982, they look like normal menorahs. In fact, the one on the National Mall, which I just lit last night, is the original one from 1979, which is the first year they did it, and it looks like a normal menorah. A week before Hanukkah 1982, the Rebbe says you have to build a 6-foot menorah according to the Rambam. The other thing that the Rebbe did at the same time is announce that from then on, every Chabadnik will be learning Mishneh Torah every day. There's something called Chitas, Chumash Tilum Tanya, that every Chabadnik is supposed to study every day after davening. It's a Seder. It's laid out in a certain format. He added Mishneh Torah to that. And if you look at when does the Seder end, in other words, you get to the end of Mishneh Torah, and Yud Aleph Nissen. And what is Yud Aleph Nissen? As every good Chabadnik knows, it's the birthday of the Melech HaMashiach. And what is the last thing you learn in the Rambam on Yud Aleph Nissen? Hilchus Mashiach. All right?
Okay. That's beautiful. That's amazing. And I encourage everyone, if you don't have access, I have access through my library. All the Modern Judaism, I can send anyone a copy of the article.
On my page on Academia.
Oh, Academia. So you can go to Dr. Firestein's Academia page.
Academia and EDU, you can download it there too.
So, but when you go to Rome and you're standing in front of the Arch of Titus, it has a big impact when you see that. And then, and you know that we're still here and we're lighting our menorahs and that empire and all the other empires are gone. And I think it's a shame not to have the actual, we know what it looked like. Ruth says, Asnat is a transliteration of an Egyptian name. So we can argue till the cows come home at how it should be pronounced. Well, we can argue how it should have been originally, but we know in the Torah how it's pronounced. And in the Torah, it's pronounced with a kamatz gadol. So how in modern Israel, modern Hebrew, people have turned it into a kamatz katan, presumably they're trying to pronounce it the way it's pronounced in the Torah. And that's what's a mistake, because it's not pronounced in the Torah, asnat. It's pronounced asnat. That's my only point.
You spoke about tikkun be'tefilati?
Yeah.
Okay. Bet tefila is a nekeva, is a feminine.
It's not. Bet tefila is a masculine. Bet tefila is masculine. It's not feminine. But you're close to something, because the pasuk in the Torah, there's a pasuk without bet that has tefila with tikkun. That's where it comes from. No, bet tefila is masculine. Justin says, my relatives in Israel pronounce this.
Bait is feminine. Bait Gadol. No, Bait Gadol. Bait Gadol.
It's masculine. So it should be Yikon. It should be Yikon Beit Tefilati. But it's not. So, by the way, sometimes Bayit, there's a few times in Tanakh where Bayit is actually feminine. That's not where it comes from.
Maybe related to Tfilah. Maybe related to Tfilah. Tfilah is what? Tfilah is feminine.
Yes, but, and there's a pasuk in Tanakh, Tikkun, where the two are put together. That's where it comes from. If I didn't plan on telling you this, so I can't remember where the pasuk is. I'll find it.
Thank you.
When we come back, I'll. I don't remember now where it is. Some of you probably can remember. There's a pasuk that has the word tikkun and tefillah next to each other. So that's it's supposed to remind us, I think, of that. Some people have actually said that tikkun should be read as like an abbreviation of techonein, and then it can be second person. Singular, but I don't think so. Rav Mazuz says about this that he says, what do you expect? Ashkenazim, it's an Ashkenazic piyut. He says, Ashkenazim don't know dikduk. So I think it's more complicated than that.
For the most part.
Yeah. Justin says that my relatives in Israel pronounce the daughter's name Asnat. Oh, okay. Okay. But I've been told that some don't. And Susanna says people make the mistake because they treat it like it's Hebrew and not a foreign word. I don't know, but if you look in the Chumash, maybe it's right. Avi says, how do we know definitively what its shape and design was? Well, we know definitively as you can know, because we have drawings, not one or two, numerous drawings from the time when there was the menorah. And they draw it almost exclusively with the curved arms. So that's the best evidence we have. Also with the tripods at the bottom. So we know how the bottom looked. It did not look like it did not have a flat bottom. That's what we know. iPad says, regarding the attack on Franco because of the seminary in Paris, Louis Jacobs attacked me, was lying to be next chief rabbi. By the way, I'll talk more about his seminary next time. And Bernard Drachman and other points about it, because you could attack it. Remember, he had Gretz was teaching there. So that's also going to be an issue for Frankel. Louis Jacobs, though, was explicit denying of traditional ideas of Torah Misina in a way that Frankel never was. So that there was a justification. Ruth says that you were taught that Ochel Mishisina is a way of indicating we don't have any other source for the practice. We've been doing it since Sinai, and that's that. Well, that is the traditional view, but we have plenty of examples where it's clear that it couldn't be that. And therefore, we have disputes, there are other things, and already you have Rishonim who say that it means an old practice whose origin we don't know. It's an ancient practice. So the point is, and this is a correct point, that the Rosh and others who say this make this an exception. That is, generally, we assume Halacha Moshe Sinai is an actual Halacha Moshe Sinai, and only a few times do we say otherwise. That's what I would say. Before I'm going to go with you, I'm going to... Hold on, I want to pull something up for you. Let me get a couple more questions, and then I'll pull something up. Rabbi Shouldn't Know. Okay, you said the same thing. Do I know offhand where the Saba Kedisha's Tshuva is? Yes, it's right to me, and I'll just give it to you. The camel issue in the Chumash. That's... Barry says his father was Rabbi Yehuda Altuski. Yes, of Hebrew national fame, so I remembered. And the nephew of Ruchem Gorella. I don't know what Dr. Abraham's site is. If you just Google Michal Avraham, you'll get the site. I don't know the name of it. I'm just pulling up something here because I wanted to get you the answer to the pasuk. of Tikkun based tefillah, see, and yes, okay. There's a no, I don't. No, I don't see the. Oh yeah, Yeshaya. Sorry, kibesi based tefillah yikare. No, how does that? That's based tefillah. I'm looking on a site that I saw that discussed it, but now I don't see it now. There is a pasuk. I have to find it. I'll find it another time. When I get back, I'll show it to you. MJ, MS Franco says, if Asas are common gadol, then the samach is a shvana. No, the samach is not a shvana. It's the kamatz is a shvanach. It's not a shvana. The reason is there's a meteg there. That maybe is the reason why, but it's a shvanach, not a shvanach.
I don't see how you say that. I mean, it's almost a standard that after a tenua gedoyla, you will get a shvanach. And the meaning of a meteg is at the very best problematic. I mean,
I know it's problematic. Yeah. I know it's problematic, but anyway. It's not. I'll show you. I'll show you right now. Hold on, let me pull. No, you're right. I'm sorry. It is a shvana. Asana. You're right. I'm sorry. I just checked it. It is a shvana. Generally after a meta, you do have a shvana anyway. So, for example, I've given the example before in.
I'll give you another example. Take Yihyeh. Mispronounced as Yihyeh. There's almost always a little mesig after the yud, but since it's an ois gronius, it cannot be a shvana. So it's got to be a shvana.
You're right. It is a shvana, asana. But we're not mocked in spoken Hebrew to use a shvana. But it's definitely a common study. You're correct. Sorry. Jacob says, Sfaradim do say asana when they read the Torah. And you say there's the mamid under the aleph, and it is a shvana. You're right. I did not remember that. Thank you. And if you hold on me for one more second here, I just want to see, I was looking at this sefer about Ma'oz Sur, and I'm just going to see quickly I'll pull it up here while you're holding on here. If he quotes the pasuk where, he thinks that, it comes from, and then we will say our good nights. I will see it right here. He doesn't cite Kibeti Vestafilo. So I don't know why. What I was referring to, I'll have to investigate it. But definitely it's Tikkun and Tikkun based tefillah. Okay, I don't know. It's, it needs to be investigated as to why it's Tikkun. Okay, Rabbi Kelman. Is Rabbi Kelman with us?
I'm right here. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. We'll see you in, I guess, 5 weeks. 5 weeks tonight, right? January 23rd, we'll be back. We hope we'll see everybody else many times in between now and then. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman's class on Sefer Daniel at 1 p.m., his ongoing series, which will be going on tomorrow, but he will not take place next week on the 27th of December. And then Wednesday, Yoni Feintuch at 12 noon is giving a Hanukkah, part of our Hanukkah series, Expert on Agadah and the Evolution of a Rabbinic Story. That's 12 noon on Wednesday. Thursday, Shuli's finishing up her series, and Shuli Mishkan. And of course, in that, if you're going to be in Israel next week, December 28th and 29th, we're doing a 2-day live tour with Shuli. Well, the first day walking tour in the old city, the second day bus tour around Gush Etzion and various places. So it's on the website. So if you're going to be in Israel the next week, that's sort of an opportunity, a mini trip, a taste of travel, as Dr. Mark would say. Not quite the same as our European trips, but really, if you can make it, that'd be great. And then Thursday night, Ruth Shane online will be giving the Parsha Shir on this week. And then, as I mentioned in the beginning, my sitter, Shir, please God, my plane arrives with enough time at 8 o'clock in the morning, 3 p.m. in Israel on Friday. And then Rabbi Liebtag will be back, kick off the week again, 11:15 on Sunday morning. So we look forward to learning with you. Please invite your friends. And everybody have a Chanukah Sameach. Don't eat too many sufganiyot. I understand they sell 20 million of them in Israel. It sounds like a lot, but that's only like three a person. So, you know, I guess for 8 days, half of one a day, less than half a day, it works out. But that is still pretty amazing. 20 million sufganiyot Israeli bakeries make. Okay. All right.
Thank you all.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mark. We'll see you in Morocco, please God. Okay.
Toda rabba.
Hagashem, Laila Tov.
Laila Tov, Hag Sameach.
Hag Sameach.
Hag Sameach.